morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, Sandy Buffett will join us. She is the executive director of New Mexico Conservation Voters New Mexico, and Carol Muldo, who is the author of a new book, The Widening, will also be joining us. Right now, I would like to welcome Jill Heppenheimer. She is co-owner of the Santa Fe Weaving Gallery, and I'd like to welcome fiber artist Jiang Chung, who is here doing an exhibition at the Weaving Gallery. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's great to have you. Now, first of all, tell us a little bit about the Weaving Gallery.
Thank you.
It's interesting that you're having a fiber artist who's not actually making textiles and who's not making things that you can wear, because isn't most of what you do things that you can wear?
Yeah, the gallery is 32 years old, and we feature artists of national and international repute who make wonderful artwear, clothing, but every so often we deviate, because we know deviation is a very important part of Santa Fe and of our collector
market. Oh, that is
market.
So true.
And Jiang Chung, who you'll be talking with in a second, is the daughter of an artist that we have featured off and on for the last 10 years, Chung Hee Lee, who does do wearable garments and is from Korea.
So you make paper using a technique called Jumchi?
Yes.
Which is a fiber technique. I guess paper is fiber when you think about it.
Yes. Actually, in old times when the fabric was really expensive in Korea, Koreans used this technique to make a paper clothing.
And so what is the nature of the technique?
Oh, it is like...
Did you say paper clothing?
Yes. So Koreans combine from 4 layers up to 20 layers of paper, and through the agitating process, we combine into one strong and durable papers that we can, after that, we sew it and wear it and even coating it. So that there is a record that diving woman even wears into the waters too.
Diving into the water,
yeah.
Wearing paper garments.
Yeah. Quilted paper garments.
Quilted paper garments. What are the fibers made of that go into the paper that you make?
Mulberry.
Mulberry.
Yeah.
So does that mean leaves or?
It's inner bark of the mulberry tree.
When you are learning traditional papermaking, how far to the source do you go? I mean, do you go to the art store and get mulberry fibers, or do you go cut down the tree, or?
I wish I can cut down the trees, but I started making pounding the inner bark trees, and then pulling out of each sheet of papers, then combining together through the agitating process. I call it felting process.
Yeah. Felting process.
Yeah.
And so it's a similar process to actually making felt, the kind of felt that people use,
yeah.
that buy at the fabric store.
Mm-hmm.
So, this paper was used traditionally. Tell us the different ways that this kind of paper is, this technique, Jumchi, has been used in Korea.
It has been used more than 1,000 years in Korea. Koreans made the paper baskets and paper chest out of this technique, and we coated them and decorate them. And somehow it has been more popular than making wooden furniture.
So making chests?
Yeah.
Okay, chests of drawers,
yes.
Or decorative chests in the house.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Is it also used for just paper to write on, paper for books?
Yeah,
or is
we
that
do too. We make nice paper books that we help birthday of families or for the recording or ceremony process.
And so you are using it for pure art,
yeah,
so to speak.
Because ancient Jumchi is folk art, and it has been function oriented, and since fabric became so convenient to get it, and this wonderful tradition is dying in Korea. So I thought if I combine a few other textile techniques into this beautiful technique, then it can be revised as contemporary art rather than just folk art. And also I can put more conceptual ideas into it, and give back the proper respect to the ancient, my ancestors. Yeah.
Is that a tension? Is that a contradiction to make it contemporary and keep proper respect?
Not to me, like, it's not contradiction, it's more like balancing each other, because for the contemporary cannot exist without the traditions, and tradition like suffering the contemporary art, if I'm making sense.
Yes, yes. We're talking to Chiang Chung. Her work is being shown at the Santa Fe Weaving Gallery on Galisteo Street this week, starting today and through the 13th of May. That's at 124 and a half Galisteo Street here in Santa Fe. You were trained both in art school in Korea and in the United States.
Yes.
What was your art training like in Korea?
In Korea, my major was oriental painting, so I literally like paint with the like oriental ink by grinding the ink and making the paper and draw onto the paper.
And what are, when you grind the inks, what are those materials? What are they made of?
Oh my God.
It's ash, isn't
it's
it?
It's not mulberry.
Yeah.
I think it's ash.
Yeah, I think it's ash.
We'll make it up. It's ash.
Ladies and gentlemen, you heard it here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. So you learned very traditional brush painting.
Yes.
And what about other things like oil painting or printmaking or things like that? Did you learn that also or not?
Not in Korea, but when I came to the Rodale School of Design, my major was like painting, so I specialized my painting in Western style, and I was like more interested in go behind the two-dimensional canvas, so I was beginning to do the installation, size-based installation, but paper was like my love of life. So like since when I was young, even my mother works with paper or time to time, so I learned how to make it by seeing her and how she like reacts to the natural materials. And since then I have been like time to time like I used like papers a lot in my work. So
let me interject that one of the things that makes Jiang's work particularly interesting is, and why I think it overlaps with her mother's work, is her mother, Chung Hee Lee, adapts the tradition of Korean pojagi, which is like a patchwork kind of process, to her clothing, and works with bast fibers.
A patchwork, now you're talking about something that we might call quilting or something like that?
It looks like, the effect is that it's not layered necessarily, but it looks, it might be all single layer, but they're pieces that are patched together.
Mm-hmm.
So it has that effect. And Jiang and her mother are working on a book on pojagi right now, and they do pojagi paper, and they do pojagi using hemp and rami as well. We don't have examples of Jiang's pojagi at the gallery, but we do have examples of her mother's right now. So that's in the gallery during this weekend while we have Jiang's work as well.
So in Korea, I mean, I'm so curious to know what the scene is like in art school. So you're a young artist, you're 17 years old, you apply to go to art school, it's very competitive. Mm-hmm. And then when you get there, you spend 4 years doing brush ink, grinding your inks and doing brush painting?
Oh, no, actually it's like similar to the Western art, like, scenery. For the first year, we learn everything, like from sculpture and from like two-dimensional like design element. But from the second year, we decide like which direction we would like to focus on.
Uh-huh.
So it's like 3 years course, and I was like decide to focus into the like oriental painting rather than Western painting. Yeah.
So what is the nature of oriental painting?
It's more like, the color-wise, it's more like nature-friendly and more like less like competitive with the environment it will be in. And it's, to me, it's more like airy and like more poetic than, yeah.
Very interesting. And is it also more friendly to the environment in the materials?
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say one of the things about taking paper into a contemporary art approach is that Jiang hangs her pieces with brackets away from the wall, and there are built-in holes and stitching, so you can see light and cast shadows against the wall. And part of her work, I think, resembles that kind of painterly style of what is the net effect visually. So it's not just paper flat against the wall, but it is the whole environment of the paper as it hangs away from the wall.
So you went to Rhode Island School of Design.
Yes.
And what was the adjustment, the cultural adjustment like for you coming from Korea and to the United States?
I mean, everything was like culture shock to me. But so I struggled at that moment, but it became more like adding back to my career and for my work too. So I'm trying to deal with the, like, Western material through the Eastern eyes. So,
And so what are you doing now? You're making this paper in the Jumchi technique?
Yes. I make one of kind paper paintings that interacts with the space and the owner that who has, because as like Jay mentioned before, it is hang away from the wall, and when the people walks by, it moves, it's like breathing with the person who owns it. So.
And so you're working not only with the traditional materials and texture of the paper, but also color and the design of the thing, so it really becomes like a painting made of paper.
Yeah.
How do you color, what do you use to color the paper?
Actually, I don't color them at any papers. After I make like several sheets of paper, I hand dyed each layers and collage them into one layer, and by using only waters and through the only agitating process, I'm breaking down the each layers of papers again and combining all of them into one layer.
Ladies and gentlemen, if we could hold it up to the microphone, we would so you could see it, but instead you're going to have to go to the Santa Fe Weaving Gallery at 124 and a half Galisteo Street. The number over there is 982-1737, and the website is santafeweavinggallery.com. Jill Heppenheimer is co-owner. Anything you want to add before we go?
Yeah, the only other thing I'd like to say is that Jiang is giving us a talk this evening at 7 p.m. at the Santa Fe Art Institute on the College of Santa Fe campus. It is free and open to the public. She'll be talking about her work. We'll have a couple of examples probably of her work, and she has a slideshow of some of the installations she's done.
And the Santa Fe Art Institute is on the campus of the College of Santa Fe. When you go in their driveway, you go all the way down to the end. And
thank
there
you.
It is.
Yeah.
Jiang Chung and Jill Heppenheimer, thank you so much for
thank
being with
you,
us.
Thank you, Charlotte.
For being us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. We're going to take a little break right now. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Sandy Buffett. She is the Executive Director of Conservation Voters New Mexico, which has just come out with the 2008 Legislative Scorecard. Welcome to the Radio Cafe. Oh, it would be good if I turned up your volume.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here.
Thank you for coming. So what is this Legislative Scorecard? Whom are you scoring, and on along what criteria?
Well, Conservation Voters New Mexico releases this scorecard. This is our fourth annual conservation scorecard of the New Mexico Legislature. And we do this because we want to provide a tool for citizens to understand how they're being represented in Santa Fe. And if they care about protecting air, land, water, our communities, and frankly, the things we love most about New Mexico, we want to shine a light on how legislators are voting on those issues. Sometimes it's very difficult for a citizen to access what's going on at the roundhouse. So
no kidding. It's very difficult. I mean, even reading the scorecard, there are so many issues that it's hard for the public to understand. And we'll talk about that in a minute. Let's start with the fact that Governor Richardson comes out with pretty high marks.
Yes. Once again, Governor Richardson proved his conservation mettle for us. You may remember at the end of the session a few months ago, I came on your show and asked your listeners to call in to request a veto. And in fact, Governor Richardson did veto the bad uranium bill. So we do highlight that in the scorecard. We felt that that bill was an inappropriate linking of creating a fund for cleaning up the old uranium sites in the Four Corners area by permitting new uranium mining.
So yeah, that sounds like a deal with the devil.
Yeah, the governor did veto that. He said New Mexicans frankly deserve better. We agreed with that. And we also highlighted the fact that under Governor Richardson's tenure, he has considerably strengthened the Oil Conservation Division, the OCD, which regulates the oil and gas industry here in the state. So we thanked him for that as well.
The sense I get from reading through this is how many very important decisions are made that very few people know about or understand, and yet, I mean, nobody knows about them because they're in this legislative process that's hard to understand. And one example is a bill whose passage was prevented by Senator Cisco McSorley of Albuquerque. Tell us about this. It has something to do with something called tax increment financing.
Right. Love the acronym.
Has
huh?
anybody heard of it?
TIFs, or TIDs, tax increment development districts, were a policy created a few years ago, and in fact, based on the experience of East Coast communities, many folks saw this as a good tool for promoting infill development in blighted areas. But what's happened is that developers recognized a loophole that they could also apply for these TIDs to apply to greenfield new real estate developments on the sprawling perimeter of our communities. So this year, out-of-state corporation called SunCal came to the legislature requesting $629 million in a bond issue, which would have diverted gross receipts taxes to repay those, and it would have then funded infrastructure for a private sector real estate development, creating sprawl on Albuquerque's west side. So we thought that was a completely inappropriate use of taxpayer money, and it created an interesting a coalition of our best environmentalists in the legislature and also the most fiscally conservative legislators who saw what kind of hit that would do to the state's general fund. And Cisco,
that's an interesting example of where different parties come together.
Absolutely, and we did see more bipartisanship this year because of those types of bills. But Cisco McSorley, Senator McSorley, and also Senator John Grubesek from Santa Fe, they filibustered, which is a very rare thing in the New Mexico Senate, for about the last hour of the legislative session, and they were our heroes in stopping that bill.
Were you actually there watching the filibuster?
Yes, we were in the gallery. We were actually running back and forth between the Senate and the House galleries. And what was amazing to me was that this year, in the last hour of the session, both chambers were fiercely debating environmental issues. And we saw our environmental champions speaking passionately on the floor. On the House side, we had some of our representatives speaking out against that uranium bill and against new uranium mining prematurely. We were frightened, of course, to see both of these bills on the verge of passing, but also heartened to see more legislators stepping up and really understanding the environmental issues that are at stake in the legislature.
We're talking to Sandy Buffett of Conservation Voters New Mexico. Then there was a bill that would have stripped environmental agencies of their staff attorneys.
Yes, this was a stealth movida in the dark of night. Last year, there were many efforts made by the Richardson administration to administratively improve our environmental regulation. One was a clean cars attempt to regulate tailpipe emissions, and the other related to oil and gas pit rules. And because of those efforts to strengthen the protection of our environment, industry, the polluter lobbyists came back at us fiercely. And they, in the dark of night, stripped the environmental agencies of their staff attorneys as a retaliatory action. We found that out, and
so they wrote a bill in the dead of night,
working with the Senate Finance Committee on removing those employees from the budget. So
on the pretext of
you know, I'm sure all those legislators justified it in different ways, but when we saw that, we did go. Actually, we highlight in our Green Deeds section, Senator Carlos Cisneros helped us. The vice chair of Senate Finance helped us reinstate those positions. Because how can an environmental agency, enforce their own regulations if they have no staff attorneys?
And that was the idea, is to make environmental agencies basically toothless, clawless.
That was exactly the idea. And we saw an unprecedented level of regulatory attacks, rollback attacks.
Who are doing
bills.
These?
These are the Oil and Gas Association, the ACI.
What's ACI?
The chamber, the...
ACI?
The business lobby.
Okay.
That pose these things as, well, these are just streamlining of regulations. And instead, what they would have done is not only threatened environmental protections, but to say that no agency can promulgate their own rules, that every rule would have to be promulgated at a citizen legislature that already has too much on its plate, would basically handcuff the agencies. And this would not only affect the environment, but it would affect nursing homes and trucking safety and meat inspection and restaurant sanitation. The good news is we killed 18 of those regulatory rollback bills. So although that was a low light, we also felt it was a highlight that we had 100% defense rate on stopping those bills.
I mean, it really does, when you talk about it, when I read about it, it sounds like the immune system.
Yeah, we really are playing defense. We need to get to a place where we are more able to pass landmark pro-environment legislation. So that's why we produce this scorecard so that constituents can hold their legislators accountable. And by the way, the ACI is Association of Commerce and Industry.
Oh, okay, right,
came to me.
Right. Now, there was a bill passed which called for 10% efficiency savings by the year 2020.
Right, and that was a bill sponsored by Speaker Lujan. In past years, we had worked on renewable portfolio standards, but efficiency was an area that the state had not paid as much attention to. So this bill creates mandatory targets for utilities to achieve energy efficiency, and increased energy efficiency is a critical tool for fighting global climate change. And the cheapest source of new energy is, in fact, in energy savings, not in creating new energy.
Now, when you put the burden on the utility to do energy efficiency, how do they do it? I mean, we think about citizens and government building more energy efficient buildings and using fluorescent light bulbs or whatever. How are the utilities charged with doing that?
Well, they actually have to demonstrate that they are helping consumers with efficiency, weatherization. And this also creates a whole new sector of green collar jobs of contractors now who will go out and weatherize homes. So this bill will still be unfolding at the Public Regulation Commission, but we felt it was a start for really addressing energy efficiency in the state.
Now there's another thing. I mean, I think reading this legislative scorecard, which, by the way, can people get hold of it either online or the very pretty periwinkle colored paper version?
Absolutely. If they have access to the internet, they can go to Conservation Voters website, which is www.cvnm.org. And if you would like a hard copy, you can call our office at 992-VOTE. That's 992-8683. And I just want to do a shout out to a sister or a colleague, another environmental organization that also released an environmental scorecard on the same day, and it tracks very closely, and that was Environment New Mexico, and they're at environmentnewmexico.org.
And so, I mean, I think one of the things that's so interesting when you read this is that there are so many ways in which, I mean, I think New Mexico is relatively citizen-friendly compared to the legislative sessions of other legislatures of other states. But there's still so much that, unless there are organizations working on this full time, that are going to fly right over our heads. Another thing that you mentioned in the scorecard is dummy bills.
Yes, the dummy bills. One of the many processes that have developed over the years at the Roundhouse that really is quite undemocratic. And this is when a bill is dropped, they say, or introduced with a very generic title, Public Peace, Health, Safety, and Welfare. And it's very difficult for us to find out what the content of that bill is until it's actually introduced in a committee. And they wait till the very last minute to introduce these things. So we really have to run around the building tracking down dummy bills to make sure that there are no environmental impacts.
So basically there's like House Bill number 666, there's nothing on it. It's a blank piece of paper. Then 2 days before the end of the session, somebody writes something on that piece of paper at 11:30 p.m., and you guys have to figure out what it is and whether it's going to hurt us or not.
Right, and these usually only get assigned to one committee, and then they get blasted out of the committee to the floor. So we sometimes...
Whereas most bills have to go through two committees.
Two or three committees, right. So we need to... track down these dummy bills, because this is where some of the most nefarious last-minute things can happen.
What are some of the nefarious things that happened this session with those?
Oh, for example, there was one dummy bill that sought to change the definition of transit so that transit funds that are meant for things like the rail runner and public busing that would actually be able to be used for highway repair, which then would completely gut the ability to build our public transportation system.
Right. Very interesting.
I wanted to mention, Mary Charlotte, just the local Santa Fe delegation, how they fared. As I mentioned, Senator John Grubasek came out at the top of the honor roll with 100%, and he proved his conservation commitment, and of course we'll miss him because he's an outgoing senator. And then at the lowest end of the scorecard was Representative Jim Trujillo, who represents western side Santa Fe, one of the lowest scoring Democrats in the state, which is surprising. So he scored at 44%.
How very odd. What's up with that?
Well, it is surprising that someone who represents a Santa Fe district would not be voting the right way on environmental issues. So I think if his constituents are concerned about that, they need to convey their disappointment. He voted on two bills. One, he voted the wrong way on a WIP memorial, which was seeking to change the classification of waste that the waste isolation pilot project down south could accept, which basically would have turned WIP into the next Yucca Mountain for
So basically, instead of having very low-level radioactive waste, it would have high-level radioactive waste.
Yes, and he voted the anti-conservation vote on that, as well as voting the wrong way on the uranium bill. And also, he voted against the Leave No Child Inside Act, which was the 1% excise tax on video games to fund children's outdoor education, to get them away from the screen time and out into the outdoors. And we felt that bill had a lot of merit, and that died
it didn't
in its
pass.
First,
it didn't pass.
It,
this
it
year.
Died in its first committee in Business and Industry.
So we're talking to Sandy Buffett of Conservation Voters New Mexico. So, but there have still been a lot of, I mean, as you say, just the very fact that environmental bills are being strenuously debated means that there has been kind of a sea change from a few years ago.
I've really seen it, and I've spoken to some of our champion legislators, and they have said it's been pronounced for them as well. The change, when we saw some freshmen coming in 2006, some of our endorsed candidates that won those seats and that are now scoring in the 90 to 100% range, that to have more allies that vote the right way on the environment and who care about having a high environmental score, that's creating more of a informal environmental caucus, if you will. I know they don't like that word up there, caucus, but
the scorecard really has an effect.
It does, and we also have had some legislators telling us that other legislators are saying, "Hey, what do I need to do to improve my CVNM score?" So I think as long as legislators are hearing from their constituents, who through this tool can be informed of how they're being represented, then that's really where the power of the scorecard lies, is when voters talk to their elected officials and hold them accountable.
Sandy Buffett is Executive Director of Conservation Voters New Mexico, which is on the web at cvnm.org. And people can give her or give the organization a call at 992-VOTE or 992-8683. Anything you want to add before we go?
Just that... We encourage everyone to get a copy of the scorecard. We're very proud of it. I think it just makes it very user-friendly and easy to understand.
It's great. It's actually fun to read.
Oh, good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. And just finally, we highlighted in the scorecard that there's a new trend, which I think is very powerful, that the environmental community has come together in something called the Environmental Alliance of New Mexico. All of our groups have various agendas, and we usually have one or two bills that we want to see passed. But we came together last year and said, collectively, our 20 groups, 30,000 members that we represent statewide, these four priorities are the bills that we want to convey to the legislature, must pass, and we will hold you accountable on them. And so that conveys a clear set of expectations to the legislature and to the governor, and it also gives them nowhere to hide too, so they can't come back at us and say, you guys want too many things. So in our first year of the Environmental Alliance, two out of the four priorities did pass, and we look forward to improving that record.
Sandy Buffett, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a little break right now. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Carol Moldau. She is a poet, and she's author of the new novel, The Widening, published by Etruscan Press, and she will be at Collected Works Bookstore on West San Francisco Street in Santa Fe tomorrow, Friday, the 9th of May at 5:30 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here. I was thinking as I was reading this book about how awkward it is to talk about sex on the radio. You can talk about anything else. You can talk about torture. You can talk about horrible things, contamination, death. But here you've written a marvelous, very interesting novel about the sexual awakening and development of a teenage girl.
Mm-hmm.
You see her in boarding school. You see her in college. And yet, it's hard to talk about. I mean, if you and I were in my house in the living room, we'd go at it for the next hour and a half. But, I mean, so, yeah, the thing that I think you do so well is really make it, nothing is held back, and yet it's very delicate and very poetic and not embarrassing whatsoever to read.
Thank you. That's a wonderful compliment. I couldn't hope for more. That's really what I was aiming for. I wanted it to be from her point of view, and even though she's sexually active and in a way wild, she's also very delicate, and I think a lot of girls on the eve of womanhood, that age, are very delicate no matter what they're doing. And, in some ways, it can be so overwhelming to be, presented with these internal desires and external messages, both, positive and negative. And so there's a delicacy there that they're very frail in some ways, and that's part of
it. Yeah, and it's there's a sort of poignant moment where she talks about where the girl who's never named.
No one
in the book is named. You talk about she and he, and that's about it. Okay. It's not the first person either. Says something like, she thought that she'd been, by having so many different sexual partners, she was numbed, and yet there she was, incredibly vulnerable all over again when somebody made some gesture or did something that made her feel bad.
Right. Well, I was thinking on my way here, what do I think finally, the book is about, or which is never how I look at my work. But in some ways, I think it really is a study, it's a character study, and it's also a study in, how to be in touch with one's feelings. What are the ways that, for any of us, but especially when you know yourself less when you're younger, how can you know what you want? There's so many overwhelming messages from your own body, from, opportunities. I mean, this is set in the 70s where, the pill is a matter of life. It's a part, matter of fact, part of life. And STDs aren't very prevalent yet. So it's just a wide open canvas for anyone that age without a lot of inhibitions, except for, say, familial inhibitions or internal inhibitions. And how do you know what you want? And I think that's her struggle throughout the book, to define, to sort of throw herself out there and then say, but what, in the end, it's a discovery of, what are my feelings? How do I balance spontaneity and self-protectiveness? How do I balance the messages my parents give me that I don't relate to at all, to the internal messages I don't understand yet. So.
And there's so much that the book makes one think about what are the cultural
yes.
influences on a young woman.
I wanted to use this intimate lens to bring up a lot of sort of cultural issues, you know, almost obliquely or underneath. I think the book does bring them up, but it doesn't necessarily directly address them.
Well, it doesn't directly address them, but you have the sense, for example, in boarding schools where no matter what the young woman's culture is, there's a kind of Anglo-Saxon overlay on the whole thing.
Right, especially I think at that time, you know, where it's set.
Exactly.
Yeah. So by Anglo-Saxon, do you also mean kind of puritanical?
Yes. Exactly.
Yes.
And so there's this sort of puritanical, and yet, you know, you've just passed a moment of sexual liberation
yeah.
going on in Woodstock and every place else.
Yeah.
And here are the young people who are too young to have been to Woodstock, who nevertheless are reaping the either rewards or the detriments.
Yeah, I think it was very influential. I mean, I know for myself, I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and, you know, the be-ins were in the paper all the time. I would drive with my parents into the city, and, you know, I'd see, you know, and the freeway entrance to the city was right by Haight, so, you know, I'd see all these street, you know, what my parents would say, you know, don't stare at people. But it was this huge imaginative influence on, I think, a lot of people who were just too young to participate, but it was all over the place.
And how long, I suppose you could calculate, how long was the window between the legalization of abortion and birth control on the one end and the beginning of AIDS on the other?
You know, I'm not sure. I think AIDS, I remember the first mention, I don't think they'd really identified it as what it was in 1980, but they were frantically trying to. So then you have to look backwards. Well, when was the pill invented?
Right.
Was that the very beginning of the 60s?
And when did women have access to it? I mean, a college girl couldn't get access to the pill if she wasn't married.
Right. Well,
until the 70s.
Well, this girl goes to Planned Parenthood in high school and is given the pill. And that would have been in the mid-70s,
right.
You know, somewhere around there. So I assume by the mid-70s college. But you had to go someplace like that. I don't think a doctor in private practice would have given that girl.
And meanwhile, the doctor in Planned Parenthood was kind of sermonizing to this
right.
very vulnerable, whatever, 16-year-old
right.
girl.
Right. There's a lot of in parental locus or whatever it's called.
I'm so curious to see how young women who are, let's say, 18 to 20 today would feel reading this book. Do you feel like it's a period piece, or you feel like it's universal?
No, I don't feel it's a period piece at all. And it's interesting to me. I have a number of friends with daughters in college, and, you know, they're all saying, I want my daughter to read this. I can't wait for my daughter to read this. But they haven't read it yet, so I'm dying to hear
yeah.
their responses. You know, what do they think? But there's that whole, you know, thing about hookups that I think, you know, has kind of a tougher stance than this girl does.
Yeah.
But that's a stance, and this girl has a tough stance too. And this is, the book is about her internally. It sort of shows her stance, and then it also shows her experience. And so I'm curious if it will resonate. With those young women.
And I think what's so wonderful about the book is that the emotional content is so skillfully and delicately and truthfully drawn that I think, you know, you could probably have read this in 1748 or, you know, 2008, and the nature of those feelings, you know, for example, of really liking somebody or being slightly repelled or terrified
right.
of somebody,
right.
And she goes through everything.
Right, she does. And, you know, I think the nature of women's experience, women's sexual experience, you know, their sort of erotic coming of age, as you said, it's hard to talk about on the radio. It's something that is still slight, you know, very taboo and very delicate and not resolved. And you see a lot of suffering because of the messages that are given to young women. But interestingly, I read from this in Ohio last month, and a a young man, like a freshman, or I think he said he was a freshman at college, said, I relate to this so much. I read the section where she's waiting for a phone call. He said, I mean, that waiting. And I just, you know, I looked at him. I was like, oh, my God, you know, this is this young
so
man.
So the dude feels exactly the same way.
The dude feels exactly the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I often wonder whether because of the equalization of sex through birth control, you know, the woman mm-hmm. isn't as vulnerable as she was when she was pretty much going to get pregnant. Whether that has also kind of androgenized the emotions of men and women. They really are more on equal footing.
I think they are. I mean, I've heard from my sister has sons and who are just coming out of their teens, and she's noted how aggressive girls are. I mean, this girl is really never aggressive. There's certain ways that she does. She's very, you know, she lives by certain standards. I mean, but my sister says that you know, young women are just very unafraid to be sexually assertive. And so that is a big change.
We're talking to Carol Moldau. The book is called The Widening, and she's going to be at Collected Works tomorrow, Friday the 9th of May at 5:30 in the afternoon, reading from the book and talking to people. There are some other things in it that I loved and I think are really important. One of them is an experience which, if it's not universal, maybe pretty close, which is mom reading daughter's diary.
Yes, I know. That's one of the threads through the book. I mean, what can you say? I think it's a terrifying experience. I have a young daughter now. I hope I never violate that boundary. You know, it. So much of this is about how you know, how can a young girl sort of have permission to express and accept her feelings? You know, how can she feel safe? And there's so many different kinds of violation, and certainly violation of privacy, and even well-meaning. I mean, I think that mother, people have different reactions to the mother. I do think she's well-meaning, but she doesn't
have a lot of
tools.
I think mothers would probably read it with a different point of view
daughters.
Than daughters.
Yes, I think that's true. But it certainly affects her, especially since the girl, you know, imagines being a writer, and so it's very inhibiting.
And she says, I'm never going to keep a diary again.
typical melodrama of a teenager, right?
Another thing that I liked, and this is just a small part of the book, but I totally related to it, which is she, as I did, took astronomy as a freshman in college, and the various things that she learned all seemed like poetic metaphors rather than just straight physics.
Yeah.
Which is how you know you shouldn't be a science
major.
That's right.
But it's so true. I mean, I think when you are a poet, you do see languages of other fields that way, whether it's astronomy or astrology. I mean, you know, even straight math and everything. The language is so rich and so potent. So if it's not really your field, but your field is language, then it just opens up, you know, worlds. But it is hard to do your homework.
Was this book hard for you to, I mean, I would think that, I don't even want to go into to what extent it is or isn't autobiographical, because it so stands up as a piece of fiction. It's so perfectly draws you into its magic and its fictional characterization. Yet, I would think if I were the person writing this, it would be a little hard to go and kind of relive that period of one's life.
Yeah, I mean, because it is an era, and certainly an era for myself and my friends, and now daughters of my friends, and it was very interesting to relive that period. You know, I don't know what to say. It was hard, but it was absorbing. It was very absorbing when I wrote it, I think I stuck very closely to her experience, and as you say, it's in the third person. And writing it in the third person, I felt allowed me to also give a little bit of perspective on her experience that she doesn't have, even though I was trying to hew very closely to the line of her experience. So, you know, I think writing it as a middle-aged or, you know, grown woman had a lot of advantage over trying to write it something like this as a younger woman.
Very much so.
Yeah.
It's interesting also, you're a poet, this is a novel, but it's not what you might call a typical novel. Each chapter is about one page long or less.
Mm-hmm.
There's there's action, but it's not really about plot.
No, it's very character, a character study in a lot of ways.
Yeah, exactly, a character study. And yet it moves along, and there's just enough of an arc to keep you going.
Oh, good.
How did you craft that? How did you think about it as you were going along?
Well, as a poet, I have written poetic sequences, and in some ways I think I envisioned this as a huge poetic sequence.
Yeah.
With a lot, as you say, with a narrative arc. And I mean, some people have asked me, well, is each one a prose poem? And each one, when I was writing it, I think I wrote it with the intensity of a poem. I mean, that's what appealed to me about the form, the intensity of each scene, which is about a page. But it's unlike a prose poem, there's a narrative thread and some sub-threads, like you say, there's the mother's, you know, reading the journal, and that I wanted to keep that arc flowing. So, but I, as a poet, I like intensity of, you know, vision and sort of pinpointing a moment. I think, you know, I was interested in using a lyrical language. It's probably a little bit more metaphorical than a lot of prose, a little more introspective and introverted. So it's, in a way, it's a hybrid. But I was very conscious of having a narrative arc, even though I wouldn't call it a traditional plot.
Would you like to read a section from the book?
I'd love to.
The book is called The Widening by Carol Moldau.
So I'll start with the opening, actually. At the crucial moment, she said yes. His hand in the back pocket of her jeans had made her wet, but nothing and no one had prepared her. They were on her bed at boarding school. Naked, she was self-conscious, and self-conscious, she was timid. He would know what to do if only she let him. She remembered letting herself be kissed when she was 12, pulled into the bushes by a classmate, happily ambushed, titillated, but sure, right up until the moment his lips pressed hers, that she would not be kissed, no matter how long they sat nested in the shrubs, because it was forbidden. He dug in, the sharp pain snapping her out of her reverie, and knowing she could not bear it if she conceived, she said no, pushing his shoulders hard with her hands. At once he was out, up, and through the door. Why had he left? In the bathroom, she looked and saw what she'd heard she'd find, blood. Her body pounded and throbbed. With the widening had come a great, unremitting pressure on her bones, and she ached inside. And that was it. She'd lost something she'd not examined having, something that until then had seemed irrelevant, illusory.
So you just go right in at the very beginning, and it goes on from there. I think it's a wonderful book and interesting for probably men and women of all ages.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I think it's an honest book. It's an intimate book that you know, I think it's revealing of a part of women's lives that is often, as you said, difficult to talk about between men and women and in public. And that's kind of a taboo that I think is important to break.
So. Carol Moldau is a poet and author of this new novel, The Widening, published by Etruscan Press, and she will be at Collected Works Bookstore on West San Francisco Street in Santa Fe tomorrow, Friday the 9th of May at 5:30. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. You can also hear the podcast at the website santafe.radiocafe.org. Anytime you want to listen to it, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features co-artists of the month, trombonist Frank Rossolino and Jimmy Cleveland. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Tomorrow, Robert Knott is here and much, much more. We'll see you then. Hasta la vista. Bye.